drawing room
over here.
Oh, hey, come on in. Luke Howard is a contemporary music composer whose style is, well, it's kind of tricky to identify. The Melbourne-based pianist is an accomplished improv composer, but it's a title he's not entirely comfortable with. While he's a contemporary classical musician in his own right, he's also a prolific collaborator, and his latest endeavour works alongside a short film and captures the crude harshness of the Australian outback. Some critics have described his music as absolutely heavenly, and I've listened and I think it's pretty much nails it. I do actually feel like I'm going to a sort of higher plane when I listen to it, and it's not bad for a review either. His new album, The Sand That Ate the Sea, has been nominated for an ARIA in the category Best Original Soundtrack or Musical Theatre Cast Album, which is also not bad. Luke, congratulations on your ARIA nomination.
Thanks, Patricia. It's my first.
That must have... Tell me, like, where were you?
Where was I? I just saw it when I was tagged on Instagram. It's a very modern way of finding out about these things. No email, nothing.
You were tagged.
I was tagged. Yeah, that was my, it was literally my notification.
Did you have to fact check? Were you like, what? What
am I? I did fact check because it was from their Instagram page, but you're right. I was like, it's in this digital world. It's where are the facts? So I did head to the ARIA website and it does appear to be the case. No one's told me otherwise in the last couple of weeks.
Okay. So we're going to stick with it.
I think you can stick with it.
Let's stick with this. How did you feel? I mean, when you spend your life dedicated to something and then you're recognized in this way, it's kind of overwhelming, isn't it?
Yeah, look, it is really nice. In a way, I feel that how to say this in a way that sounds respectful. I think
you deserve it.
Well,
that's what you want to say.
No, not so much that. I feel that because the arts is so, you know, the rewards and things are so up and down in the artistic world. Over the years, I've learned to become more reliant on my own kind of pilot light or something. Like it does, and the danger of that, of course, is that you don't appreciate the successes, but it's a way of insulating yourself from the bits when things aren't going so well. So I have, and I don't want this to sound disrespectful, I'm really honored to have been nominated, and I hope I win, of course, but as the years have passed, I think I've become less reliant on external kind of validation, and it's just a way of persevering in the arts. Suffice to say, a long career in the arts is challenging. And I think you have to find ways to navigate that in a way that are internally rather than externally validated.
I don't think it's dark. I think it's the opposite, actually.
I think that's just
which
the
is
realistic
not
side
trying
for me.
To get the quick hit, the quick adoration.
And I think also
love.
In this contemporary world where, you know, we're ruled by the dopamine hits of Instagram and all those things that possibly any reward, the kind of efficacy of that neural thing isn't it's not as great as it once was, perhaps, because you're always bombarded with we're in an age of chasing dopamine rewards, and anything you can do to kind of step outside that, I think, is important, particularly if you're trying to create art.
So how would you describe your genre? Because it's not really a genre that strictly exists in the world.
Well, yeah, I mean, I feel it kind of fits in the contemporary classical Monica, simply because it's contemporary and it's, you know, it's instrumental music with classical instruments. But as I, coming from more of a performing background and not studying composition, I guess, as kind of what you alluded to before, have never really felt comfortable inheriting the composer kind of archetype. But I put in the contemporary classical world. There are a bunch of terms like post-classical and neoclassical that get floated around, but I feel the music that gets lumped under that is often as different as it is similar, and it's kind of, I think it's just a convenient umbrella term for talking about instrumental music that is tonal and accessible, and that people that are not necessarily classical music aficionados will want to listen to.
So who influences you?
Oh, everybody. I mean, I try to, everything going back to when I was a kid and listening to, you know, Crowded House and John Farnham, but, and also all the classical music I play, you know, Bach and Beethoven, all of those guys, even though I don't practice them as much as I used to. And then jazz musicians like Pat Metheny and Keith Jarrett, which was kind of my sort of early 20s music education. And then contemporaries, people that are living and writing music, people like Arvo Pärt and Pateras Vasks in the more kind of classical world, and then these names will be familiar, I'm sure, to a lot of your listeners, people like Max Richter and Johan Johansson, who really, I think, spearheaded this particular arc of contemporary classical music. And, you know, I'd be lying if I said my music doesn't draw on that aesthetic. I love listening to those guys. There's no shame in admitting it's music I love. And whilst my goal in creating music is to will into existence something that doesn't exist yet, I want to create music I love as much as the music that I didn't write that I love.
Tell me about your kind of career. How did it all begin for you? Was music always there from a really early age?
Yeah, but I think it's a classic case of overnight success is like 30 years in the making, if I'm even an overnight success. But so I started learning the piano when I was 4 and a half, so I have been tickling the ivories of plastics for some 35,
and did you love
years.
It immediately?
Well, I reckon you go through phases as a kid. I'm sure I loved it immediately. I mean, don't really have a musical family, but I think I took to it, and then you go through phases where, you know, getting up at 6 in the morning to practice the piano when you're a teenager is not fun. And towards the end of high school, I kind of stopped because it just wasn't possible to keep that kind of dedication up and do, you know, VCE. So I had a few years out, and then I went to VCA and studied jazz. And then in my 20s, I kind of also worked in the computer industry, and that kind of sucked my time away from music. So it was really only in the last 10 years or so where I kind of got more serious, and it did coincide with discovering that there was a way of writing music that was beautiful and has some kind of emotional narrative and my friends would like. You know, I think for better or for worse, one thing about studying music in an academic context is that complexity is always valued and simplicity and emotion. I mean, this is a generalization, mm-hmm. but, you know, it was always like more notes, louder, faster, more complex. And if you're learning or being educated in that kind of, even if it's not directly what your teachers are telling you, you kind of suck that culture in. And it took me many years to shake that and then to honour simplicity in music.
On RN, I'm Patricia Carvelis. You're in the drawing room, and Luke Howard is my guest. He's a contemporary music composer, and his new album, The Sand That Ate the Sea, has been nominated for an ARIA in the category of Best Original Soundtrack or Musical Theatre Cast Album. And we know that he found out on Instagram, so he's a thoroughly modern person. How did you know you're onto something? I mean, I love that story about your journey and the stops too, because that's a really good question.
I can remember both feelings in this particular, you know, recent classical kind of arc. I suppose I knew I was onto something when the first record, Suncloud, which was in this world that I made, released independently, and the first time I'd really written for strings. And so it had a bit of that first album kind of, whilst it wasn't, I'd made many records before, it was like, I'm going to put everything into this. And, you know, and when you release something by yourself, like, I mean, how does anyone find it? But somehow...
It's a very crowded market.
I mean, it was less crowded in 2012, 13, but it just seemed to have a slow kind of momentum of a ball rolling down the hill. When Marianne Hobbs played some on BBC Six and it seemed to get a great response, that's when I felt I was onto something. Paradoxically, that was also the feeling of being of a stop as well, because I was here in Melbourne, you know, getting this great feedback, but without any way to capitalize on it. I couldn't really, it's hard to organize a gig in London like the next week when you live a million miles away, and I didn't have a manager or a label or any of that infrastructure that's useful in order to try and, you know, to strike when these opportunities come or this. Yeah. So that's when I both knew I was onto something, and also remember feeling just frustrated and wondering whether these opportunities were just slipping through my fingers. I mean, I guess that's an example of wanting external validation as well, but,
that's, you know, okay. It's nice. You can want some.
You want an audience. Also, I think even just from a career perspective, if you want to turn it into a career, you do need to take every opportunity, because the opportunity bus comes around once or twice if you're lucky. And then so in the intervening years, managed to have some of that infrastructure. So I'm with a label in the UK and have someone in Europe that helps me get gigs and a publisher. And those things, though, they don't – my experience in the arts is that if you go looking for those things, they rarely come. You really have to wait for them to knock on your door, and there's no telling when that happens. So in a way, it is it's like, are you still standing, you know? And in the interim, you have to still be valiantly making art, you know, the same enthusiasm and tenacity and motivation that you did the first record.
So where do you draw your biggest inspiration? How do you keep making that art, especially at times when, as you've described, you're frustrated, you know, you're kind of like, how do I seek these opportunities? How do you keep being creative when everything else seems
It can be challenging. Certainly when you're doing, like with this last record, music, which was originally for a film, then that's immediately a bunch of parameters and deadlines and aesthetic ideas that lead you to a solution, a creative solution, much more quickly than if you're just, oh, let's write some music. Of course, sitting down to make something with with few boundaries is also very satisfying, even it can be a bit harder to get started. I think the two things that, firstly, for me, it's not possible to be creative all the time. Like, I'm not going to make a record of my own every year. Like, for me, those things take time, and if I tried to do it any faster, I'd just end up cranking out variations on the same idea. And the other thing is, when the ball does start rolling and you feel a sense of ownership of it, and you're like, okay, this is mine, and even if, and the pride, all of that comes purely from the creative act rather than wondering how it's going to do, that's the best feeling. Because again, it comes down to external versus internal motivations. When it's all within your control, no one's stopping you from writing the greatest piece of music ever, except perhaps your own limitations. And as long as you think it's the greatest you can do, as long as you've done the best you can do, as everyone's parents would have said when you're a kid, as long as you do the best you can, then that's really rewarding. And then the rest, in terms of commercial success, is that's just the icing on the cake. So it's a matter of finding those motivations. But yeah, getting started is hard. I spend weeks, if not months, procrastinating.
And do you have a kind of practice, something that can get you going? Do you do things?
I think for me, it's just simply having enough other actually, this is where external motivation can be useful. When you've got things to do for other people, it keeps your skills sharp, and it also reminds you that your own time is not to be taken for granted. There's nothing like that helps you value your own time like having to do something, a project for someone else that maybe you're not so, you know, motivated about. You're like, wow, when I get back to my own time, I'm going to do all these things. So having complete free time is that's actually really dangerous.
And where does the idea come from for a song or a musical score or something that you're working on? Is it in your head, or do you kind of start playing with the keyboard? How does it come about?
I mean, the kind of structural ideas, like I want to make a record for a particular ensemble or something, they're things I just ponder, because they're more related to, you know, what haven't I done before or what might sound interesting. But the actual spark of, like, where does an idea come from? I don't know where that comes from. I mean, it can be prompted by feeling a certain way, or, you know, being, for example, in a situation when you're distracted. Sometimes when you're sound checking before a gig and you just noodle something out on the piano, that's where a lot of ideas have come from, because somehow conscious mind is completely distracted. And then like, hey, let's record that on your phone and we can save it for later.
So you always know, do you? You're like, oh, wow, I just did something there.
Yeah, definitely. Because those ideas, those unconscious ideas are so, at least the ones that are any good, are so rare. Like, you know, you want to make a note of it. And then hopefully when you need the ideas, you can go and mine those.
And how is technology influencing your music and the way you create your music? Has it changed your practice?
It's good and bad. I mean, obviously it's great for, you know, you don't have to write music out by hand. You can, and if you need to make a revision, it's easy. And if you want to add effects, if you want to even do a lot of things that once would have required the skilled labor of a professional, like mixing a record, you can probably do a good enough job yourself and then get someone in to kind of, you know, help you polish it at the end. So there's a lot of economic and advantages. And so it's super useful. And this aesthetic is defined by a mixture of classical instruments with some electronic sounds in a way that maybe has become a bit tropish, but that wouldn't exist without technology. Mm. So for it to become a trope. But also, yeah, look, it can be a hindrance too, because it's, you know, it's kind of like looking at your phone. There's always something to fill with. And I actually, you know, I was just talking to my dad last night about, I wanted to bring my desk, like dining table, from home into the studio, just so I have somewhere to work at with a pencil and paper, where my eyes aren't being bombarded with light. And there is something that keeps you very honest about just a pencil and paper. I mean, it can
sound, get a piece of paper. Yeah, I completely agree.
It's like, I mean, you can't be distracted. It gives you exactly what you put in, whereas a computer gives you what you gives you back, but it also distracts you with all of these kind of shiny trinkets. Like, maybe let's try and
it shortens your attention span.
Exactly. What can you do to maximize your attention span in this modern world so that you might actually do something creative and beautiful in a way that you would have done, you know, even just a short 10 years ago?
And this latest album has a real sacred feel. What drew you to that style? I mean, I said, you know, a review said kind of heavenly.
Yeah, well, it's funny. It's really the Matthew Thorne, who's the director, this young guy from Adelaide, he's like 26, very strong ideas, very interested in sacred music, you know, using the choir. And so he had so many ideas that were musical that he kind of, you know, I just went along with him, really, and he pushed me in ways that I wouldn't have pushed myself, and I'm really grateful to him for that. And, you know, he's like, all right, we need a choir. And I of course, my conservative reaction's like, you realize how much that's going to cost? You know, we found a way to make it work, and having not written for choir before, I think it also captured a bit of that, like, okay, I don't know what I'm doing, so I'm going to have to really explore and make sure everything's in its right place, whereas, you know, to write a piece for piano, I can do that so much more easily that perhaps sometimes I'm in danger of taking that for granted a bit. Yeah, it was creatively a great partnership, and Matthew was always saying, look, you know, it's about the album. I want you to make an album that you're proud of, and don't worry about the film. So it was one of those collaborations where I think we felt we both...
And you just mentioned film, writing for writing a film score. So does that mean writing for a visual element as well? Does that come into the way you write?
As I said, Matthew encouraged me to watch the film and then to go away and write some music, which is something that's becoming more and more common, I think, with the recent Joker soundtrack. That's what the director did, you know, sending a script or something. But I kind of
watch the film.
Or even in the case of the Joker, it was like read the script, write the music, and then, which is it's a different approach. It's almost more similar to taking a bunch of tracks from a record and placing them in a film. I mean, I did watch the film in the case of The Sand That Ate the Sea, and I was really keen to make something that would work with it, because I feel that's what separates film composition from just making a record. But because the edit did change so much and it ended up being a lot shorter than it was originally going to be, and I'd already kind of gone down into this sort of rabbit warren of making an album, it did turn out to be a bit of halfway between that. So when I finished the music, Matthew fit it into the film, into the final edit. I mean, that worked because the music's very, and the film's very laconic and slow moving. It was a chase sequence. You can't do that. You've got to know what's happening on screen. You've got to be able to edit to every scene change and every beat. But it worked for this, and particularly because the music, I started off improvising music to an edit, but that was almost twice as long as it ended up being. So we had a lot of music left over.
And how self-critical are you? I'm thinking quite a bit.
I'm pretty self-critical. I mean, again, working with Matthew is really good in that regard, because if he thought something was done, he's like, you know, let's stop, which is sometimes the thing you need to hear, because often if something comes easily and you haven't rewritten it five times, you think it can't be any good. But he also pushed me when he thought it could be better, and that's great. That's like working with a producer in the old-fashioned sense. Otherwise, you're right, I am self-critical. But
you rework your pieces quite a bit, right?
Yeah, I mean, if I'm writing something to be performed by strings or something, that's the day you turn up to the recording session, you're throwing a lot of money very quickly. So I'm really careful that getting the most, that the piece is as good as it can be.
So it's cooked.
You're ready.
You're ready to go.
Yeah. But I think the thing, you know, it's a truism that albums aren't finished. They're kind of just not abandoned, but like they are as good as they could be at that time. And then
Do you find it hard to let go of your babies?
Yeah, I do. But, you know, but I'm also a real believer in finishing things, because, you know, how many people do you know that have got these ideas that never even start, let alone finish? And I've always had that little voice in the back of my head. I'd much rather finish something and not be perfect, and then I can learn from it. Do the next thing, because there's a whole set of things you only learn from finishing stuff. And just having the ideas is not enough.
Hey, Luke, thanks for coming in.
Thanks, Patricia. Cheers.
Luke Howard is a contemporary music composer, and he has a new album, The Sand That Ate the Sea, and it's been nominated for an ARIA in the category of Best Original Soundtrack or Musical Theatre Cast Album. That's it for RN Drive tonight. I'm Patricia Carvelis. I'll be back on your radio tomorrow. Catch you then.